case for today is GD12AP 1769, 1770, and 1863, State versus Martin O'Brien, State versus Kathleen O'Brien, State versus Charles D. Butts. And answer a request for additional time, which the court granted. It is going to, the lineup will be Jerome Hooting, 30 minutes representing the O'Briens, Terry Rose, 10 minutes representing Charles Butts, 45 minutes to Assistant Attorney General Castle representing the state of Wisconsin, and then another 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay? All right. That's accorded to you. You may use it or not use it as you wish. We will begin with the counsel for the O'Briens. 30 minutes, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien. My name is Jerome Buting, and I am here arguing today on behalf of Kathleen and Martin O'Brien. The case before us today involves the use of hearsay at preliminary hearings. A preliminary hearing that, in this case, the lower court and the prosecutor downplayed as a mere perfunctory step in the process. But for the clients that sit next to me at the table in court, it's not a perfunctory process. A hearing, the preliminary hearing, is a very important stage. It's the first chance they get to have an independent magistrate look at the state's charging decision, look at some of the evidence, and then make a very important decision about whether they need to suffer the extra costs, humiliation, anxiety of going to trial on a felony charge. So it is a very important. As we talk about this today, I don't want us to lose sight of the historical importance of the hearing and why it matters to clients. Now, this court, a few years ago in State versus Schaefer, reaffirmed that principle and said that the preliminary hearing still serves as an independent check on the power of the executive, in this case a prosecutor. Former Justice Babelich said in State versus Williams that the state should not resent the review of their charging decision.
Do you view this statute as a issue on separation of powers, because this statute talks about evidence? Usually rules of evidence are for this court, not for legislature, and says what the basis upon which a decision can be made, and that's generally for the courts too. I know that's not the one you're presenting. You're presenting a separation of powers issue, but not the one I'm talking. But I didn't see anyone discuss the separation of powers issue that I'm talking about.
I didn't. I think that it doesn't necessarily invade the separation of powers, because the statute's worded so broadly, that's one of the problems. I think it was the legislature assumed that courts would continue to act in some sort of gatekeeping function to limit the use of hearsay to only reliable hearsay. And in theory, that's a good. That may work, but in practice it really hasn't worked that way as we look at some of the examples.
It doesn't say reliable hearsay. You're adding a word to the statute.
It doesn't say which?
Reliable
Correct.
Hearsay.
It does not. And I'm asking the court, through the exercise of its inherent power or its superintending authority, to control the litigation in the lower courts, to impose some sorts of limits to ensure that not all hearsay is admissible, but only if it's reliable enough.
Isn't that what the decision of the Court of Appeals does here? I note that in paragraph 2, it says, it remains the duty of the trial court to consider the apparent reliability of the state's evidence at the preliminary examination in determining whether the state has made a plausible showing of probable cause. This determination is to be made on a case-by-case basis. And the Court of Appeals concludes with their with its introductory holding by saying, but admitting hearsay evidence at the preliminary examination presents no blanket constitutional problems. So sounds to me like that's what at least the Court of Appeals here is doing, inserting and perhaps emphasizing a reliability element to the statute.
Well, it does say that at the beginning of the decision. Later in the decision, it also says that the defense counsel should not have the ability to challenge the competence or reliability of the evidence, which is contradictory and confusing. I think the problem with this opinion is that it doesn't give any guidance to the lower courts. And the examples that are in the Amici's brief and in our appendix show that the lower courts need that guidance because they are not really following it. There's really been no exercise of a gatekeeping function here. And so while the Court of Appeals has confidence that the circuit courts will be able to sort this out, I think this is the sort of situation where we're talking about control of evidence, potentially unreliable evidence. After all, hearsay is presumptively unreliable. At least it has been for hundreds of years. Now, certain types of hearsay have developed indicia of reliability that courts have permitted, and I think that's what we need here is some sort of guidelines or rules that can tell the courts what type of hearsay is permitted and which type is not. It's not enough to simply file a criminal complaint. There's another issue that we raise is the whole question of the standard level of probable cause. Prosecutors are, in some parts of the state, are simply filing a criminal complaint and saying that's all we're going to do. We want to bind over on the basis of that, when we know by case law that preliminary hearing requires a higher burden.
Well, you're saying file a criminal complaint. Don't they need a witness who's at least going to read the criminal complaint into the record?
In one instance, apparently, according to the Amici's, they didn't even do that. They just asked the court to take judicial notice of the criminal complaint.
Well, you know, I looked at that, so I went back to a case I had written a while back in a concurrence comparing probable cause under a whole variety of cases. And I found that, although it's not consistent in the cases, that probable cause in a complaint is less than, say, the cases, probable cause to bind over in a criminal, in a preliminary.
Correct.
So tell me, on the basis of your experience, because I doubt it will be in the record, what is the barest criminal complaint you can have? Do you know what I'm saying? Because it might be good enough for a complaint, but it might not be good for a preliminary hearing. On the other hand, it might be. Do you know what I'm trying to express to you?
And I think maybe some of the counts in this particular case are an example of that. The complaint is very sparse. One sentence.
In this case, it's sparse.
The O'Briens.
What does it say?
In count 10, it consists of one sentence. Where essentially, quote, SMO reported that sometime between February and May of 2011, Martin O'Brien hit SMO in the chest with a flashlight. SMO stated that the blow caused him pain and numbness in his body. That is the sum total of evidence in the criminal complaint that supports a felony child abuse on that count. And there's others like that, where there's another one where this young man, SMO, claims that he was kneed in the groin. Again, with no context, no explanation of how this came about, whether there was horseplay or whether it could have been inadvertent.
Counsel, do you have a right as defense counsel to request the court
cause the state to make the statements in the complaint more definite and certain?
You do, and in fact, I think a motion was filed before the preliminary hearing in this case, and it was actually just taken under advisement, and the hearing proceeded. So that's one remedy, but it doesn't necessarily require that they're going to produce as much evidence as I think would be necessary to satisfy the higher level of probable cause for a bind-over in a preliminary hearing. But
tell me how your argument factors into, for example, transactional analysis case law.
Transactional analysis?
In that, you know, you can have a prelim on one count, but you could be charged after prelim with a number of counts. You don't get a new prelim on all those counts. I almost hear your response to Justice Rogenczak, like, yeah, this is notice pleading, and we have the right to have more definite, and we need to know about each charge and what the... I mean, you kind of do, but it's not like you start over and you get a new proceeding, and prelims aren't discovery, so I'm trying to figure out how that factors in, or if you've thought about it. I'm not trying to ask an unfair question either.
I have. In this case, it's a little bit different because the prosecutor specifically asked at the beginning of the hearing for a bindover on all 10 counts, all felonies. She made it clear she didn't want just a bindover on one. The judge asked, can I bind over if I find probable cause on one? She said, no, I want a ruling on all 10 counts. She didn't want to have to litigate the transactional issue of whether they're wholly unrelated or not, because there's a very wide charging time frame of 7 years here from 2004 to 2011, I think maybe part of the reason for that. But in this case, I don't think that that's ultimately going to be determinative because the prosecutor did ask for a bindover on all counts.
I guess my question goes to the broader issue, which is why this case is here. It's not just here for these people. It's here for what should the rule be for every prelim from this point forward. So if the logic is I should know what I'm being charged with and be able to hear the evidence on that charge, then that case law needs to go, doesn't it? Because in those cases, you won't ever hear that.
Well, and you're right about the notice question, but that's only part of it. If, in fact, the defense is allowed to challenge the plausibility of those cases that are presented and that whatever little notice might be given at a preliminary hearing, the defense may never have to cross that bridge, for one thing. If the court doesn't find probable cause to bind over, then there won't be any other charges that could be added. So I think whatever decision comes out of this case is really going to be more focused on the hearing itself and what sort of evidence should be permitted and what sort of cross-examination and confrontation and all of that should be presented, rather than the secondary question of what kind of charge could be added to the information, if I understand the justice's question.
So what kind of hearing do you want?
I think a hearing, the kind of hearing we want is a right to confrontation, whether it's Sixth Amendment or due process, wherein the defendant has a right to confront the accusers against him. It's not a full-blown trial. It's not even a mini-trial, because whatever kinds of questions are asked or evidence is presented, it's still got to fit within the narrow framework of plausibility of the story. It can't be obviously challenging the credibility of the witness. But to not present any witness and to present nothing but hearsay completely denies the defendant any opportunity to make a meaningful challenge to the plausibility of the case.
I see those as different things, though. I mean, if the state has not introduced testimony that meets the plausibility standard, the case is out. I mean, it's and it should be. But that's different from the opportunity to present your evidence and witnesses and fully cross-examine a witness. I mean, if you're sitting there as the judge hearing a prelim, and that's what we did in Washington
Sure.
County, judges heard them, not commissioners, general. If you've got, let's say you present witnesses, and they're great witnesses, but the state presents witnesses, and they're good witnesses. We don't weigh and consider who we think is more believable.
Correct.
That's a bind over all day long, right?
Correct. But in the past, what always happened was, whether it's if it's an eyewitness identification case, as in Wilson, or if it's a case involving where a alleged victim is in as like a transactional witness, the defense was always able to cross-examine, and as long as the questions were limited to the plausibility of the story and the elements of the offense, that was always permitted. And you know, how, where were you? What kind of opportunity did you have to observe what it is you say you saw? All those kinds of questions were permissible in the past, and they're not now. If the state doesn't have to present the witness, and as in this case, if the defense is then precluded from calling the witness. Really, what this statute, all it does, it doesn't abolish preliminary hearings. It wasn't intended to do that, I think, because look at all the other parts of the hearing that it kept. The statute didn't do anything about 970.03 sub 5, where the defense still has a right to cross-examine and call witnesses. The legislature did nothing with that. They didn't say that the rules of evidence no longer apply at preliminary hearings. That's still the case. So I think that it's the problem is that the statute is worded so broadly that it's opened the door for prosecutors to turn the proceeding into a meaningless exercise, really what it is. You can't cross-examine a piece of paper. And really all it's, at best, all this statute should do is say, all right, the prosecutor no longer has the obligation to call these witnesses. You can use hearsay. But if the defense, in those few cases where they have hearings, keep in mind, most hearings are waived. Most hearings, there really isn't much in dispute, and there's not much to be gained by the hearing. But in those cases where the defense does exercise their right to have a preliminary hearing, then even more so than in the past, that right to present evidence and cross-examine state's witnesses should be more liberally interpreted, because otherwise the hearing really is a totally meaningless exercise where there's no opportunity to challenge plausibility.
You want this court to strike it all and say, hey, it's a meaningless exercise and we're not going to participate? The end.
No, I don't think the court should do that, nor I don't think the court can do that, frankly, because the legislature created preliminary hearings, and the legislature could choose to abolish them and go back to the grand jury system, but they haven't done that. They've chosen to stick with a preliminary hearing for a lot of reasons, and some of those were in the 1982 study by the Judicial Council that I included in the appendix. So,
but they don't have to keep it the same as before, right? They can amend it. And they amended it to allow hearsay. And you're not going to, do you want the court to say no hearsay?
I want the court to say what we proposed as our guidelines.
Page what of your brief?
I believe it's on page 9 and 10.
All right.
And that is to preclude the use of mere readers, someone who doesn't have anything to do with the case, that they just call and have them read the complaint.
No personal belief, right?
Correct. Those kinds of witnesses should not be permitted.
Well, what about an officer who has spoken to the victim? Is that good enough?
If the officer... This is assuming we get past the constitutional confrontation issue. Only if the officer has enough information that he can provide to the magistrate to show that there's some reasonable, reliable source for the hearsay declarant's statement. That is, was the person in a position where they could see what they saw, what they say they saw, something that the court can determine not just plausibility but reliability of the evidence is presented before them, because that's the fundamental precept of even a finding of plausibility is that evidence has to have some degree of reliability. If the officer came in and said, I talked to this alleged victim and she took a polygraph and she passed, well, that wouldn't be enough. That's unreliable. This court's found polygraph evidence is unreliable. And that an example of the kind of limits that this court has placed in the past. It's also psychiatric testimony in Steele versus State, where the court said, we're not going to just allow a psychiatrist to come in and express an opinion about whether someone has the capacity to form intent. State versus Armstrong with hypnotically refreshed testimony. And in Durrell, where the court said, we need some control over the litigation and the type of evidence that we hear in our courts, so we're now not going to allow juvenile interrogations in custody that are not electronically recorded. Those are the kinds of areas where the court has stepped in and said, it is our prerogative to control the evidence. It's a very broad power, the type of evidence that we're going to rely on. And this statute is just worded so broadly that you know, we can see by the examples that Amici has brought in that, you know, if you give the government an inch, they'll take a mile. And if they're unchecked, that's what's going to happen. We will lose, as I think we have already, any meaningful, independent review of the prosecutor's decision until it goes all the way to a trial.
I've read your 10 and 11, and it's one, precludes the reader, two, requires testimony or sworn affidavit by a witness whose personal knowledge, three, sufficient underlying facts for preliminary hearing court to make reasonable inference that the source of hearsay are probably truthful and reliable, and four, provide that any hearsay statements and identifying information be given the defendant at least 5 days before the hearing so the defendant can exercise his or her right to subpoena the witness. Now, you subpoenaed the victim here, one of the victims, right?
One of the alleged victims, yes.
And you did not, he or she did not testify, isn't that right?
No, the state objected, moved to quash, and ultimately the court agreed and quashed and would not allow us to call the witness, who is a 17-year-old young man, 2 weeks short of his 18th birthday. And so not your typical child victim where you have to be concerned about the youth of the witness and all of that. Basically, on the argument that, look, we've already demonstrated probable cause through our hearsay declarant. So unless you can prove that this witness will defeat probable cause and tell us exactly what he's going to say, you can't call this witness. That's essentially the approach that the state and the circuit court took. And that's way too high of a burden to ask any attorney at that stage of the case. There's been no discovery. It wasn't required in Wilson, for instance, before the court said it was error to deny the defense counsel the right to call the eyewitness and ask what description did you give the police. They didn't say, well, he has to first know what that was. So that's the impossible burden that was really imposed by the circuit court in this case. And particularly if you're going to allow hearsay.
But counsel, if that witness had been permitted to testify, wouldn't have that called for a weighing of the credibility of the evidence? And I thought I heard you acknowledge in response to Justice Eagler's questioning that credibility is not an issue at preliminary hearing.
That's correct. It's not an issue, and it would not have entailed any questions of his credibility. Counsel.
No, not his credibility, the credibility of the competing versions between the complaint as submitted by the state and the proffered witness.
Well, that depends. If the witness admitted, yes,
I'm sorry, counsel. Please continue.
Okay. If for instance, the witness, let's take the flashlight count for an instance. If the witness had said, oh, well, you know, the power was out and we were, you know, he was walking around with the flashlight and I came running down the stairs and he hit me in the chest. Without any apparent intent, but it hurt, then under those circumstances, the court could say, well, I've heard both versions. Now that I know the context of how this happened, I don't believe there's probable cause because there's nothing that shows that it was an intentional act.
I thought you recited that count as including intentionality and causation of physical pain.
No, no. It's in the appendix, the complaint. It says nothing about intent. All it says is, between the two-month period, I was struck by a flashlight in the chest, and it caused pain, or it hurt, or something like that. Nothing about that he said, yelled at me before he hit me, or anything like that.
Couldn't you challenge that, then, on the face of the complaint, as being legally insufficient to meet the elements of battery?
See, counsel did do that, and like I said, that the motion on the complaint was deferred until after the hearing, and so in the hearing itself, counsel again argued at the end of it when they were asking for a bind over. And in this case, the court, I believe that's what provoked the court to say that, well, now that there's been this change in the statute, this hearing is more perfunctory than it ever was, so I'm going to bind over. And he basically said, well, I can infer from maybe the child was terrorized or something like that. It showed, I think, a misunderstanding on the part of the court.
It showed a what? I'm sorry. Some noise.
Misunderstanding on the part of the court of the burden in a preliminary hearing. That shouldn't be. You can't just infer with nothing else than that one sentence. Because that's all there was. You can't infer that there was intent or that there was the elements of a felony child abuse took place. And the court said there was. Again, relying on the fact that the legislature had amended the statute and therefore it's more perfunctory now. We don't have to worry as much as we did. And I think that's just wrong. And I think that it really turns these hearings into a meaningless exercise unless this court can give some guidance and go back to the roots of why do we have preliminary hearings? The statute says it's probable cause. But the courts have said there's more to it than that. Yes, the express language says all you need is the purpose of the hearing is to find probable cause to believe a felony was committed. But there's all of the other reasons to prevent hasty, improvident, malicious, or oppressive prosecutions, to avoid the anxiety and humiliation of a trial, et cetera, et cetera. So the court has already grafted onto the statute more meaning than what the express words say on the purpose of the hearing. What I'm saying now is the court needs to do something similar, and explain what type of reliability needs to be established.
If the test at a preliminary hearing is the plausibility of the state's version, of the prosecutor's version, then in the instance of the count in regard to being struck with a flashlight, why wouldn't your complaint really be the state did not meet the elements of that offense?
Well, that's part of it. But the reason the court ruled the state didn't meet those elements is because the court thought that now basically everything's fair game. They don't have to do much anymore.
Well, right. I understand that, but your complaint, what you are complaining of at this point, seems to me to be a failure to even meet the essential elements of the offense.
Correct.
And so. If the court were to find the law constitutional, wouldn't the remedy be to have that struck as having failed to meet the elements of the crime?
Well, that could be one remedy, but I don't think this court took this case to rule, make one correction of error. I think this case involves broader principles with the whole procedures that are being used all over the state. And this is just one example.
I understand what you're saying. And it is, this particular instance where the proffered witness, the offer of proof was to provide context to supply missing elements. So therefore, it would be the odd case where it would not be a competing version of events, but rather a fleshing out or context, as you say. But I also understand something similar is kind of happening right now in that, you know, I'm asking you, why wouldn't it be a failure of meeting the essential elements? And you keep, and you come back to saying, well, the judge said it's just a perfunctory. That may very well be error.
Well, it is error. I'm not denying that, but I'm saying it's an example of a broader problem that's happening, and it happened on other counts in this. That was
so. You're citing it for the. So if I understand, I think I'm beginning. You're citing it for the general proposition that this is more reflective. That the law is encouraging the idea that even the criminal complaint doesn't matter, even the meeting of essential elements doesn't matter.
Correct.
That's what I see.
Okay. That's right. And I don't think the law is encouraging that. I think the law is written so broadly that the state has sort of taken that and run with it and taken it to the extreme, where they are not only trying to avoid putting on any witness themselves, but to also deny the defense the right to do that.
But my point is, and I agree with you, that the court didn't take it to correct one count in one criminal complaint. That's very obvious. But I also observe that even if the law were applied, that you would have a remedy for that particular instance, that the law doesn't contemplate that the state isn't going to have to meet. And I stand to be corrected, but my understanding is the purpose of the law is not to excuse the state from meeting the bare elements of the offense. Go ahead.
I see the red lights on.
Please go ahead and answer and respond if you'd like.
Yes, you should answer, please.
Okay. The problem is, you're right, that the law doesn't do that, and the law doesn't do a lot of things that the state is trying to get away with now. But without some clear guidance from this court, or even the Court of Appeals, we made the same argument to the Court of Appeals, and they didn't correct the error. I mean, this is just an example of why the lower courts really are misunderstanding what the legislature did by amending this one evidentiary aspect of the hearing. And so that's what I'm asking. That's why I think the court really needs to send a strong message with guidelines or some other.
One little question. Are you asking us to use our supervisory authority to do this, or are you saying this hearing is constitutional in nature?
Well, we haven't even gotten to that. I have a whole argument about why it's constitutional under the right to confrontation. But what I'm saying is if the court gets past that step and the court finds that the constitutional right to confrontation does not apply, then I am asking the court to use its superintending authority to impose the rule.
I just wanted to make sure I had it in its spot.
Okay. Thank you.
If I may.
Prosser.
Several members of our court have been also members of the Judicial Council. I don't know if this is true when the Chief was a member, but for many years now, there's been a sweeping revision of the Criminal Procedure Code that included a provision to completely eliminate preliminary examinations.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of us know that that's probably coming. How do we deal with your requests and your concerns about this, the present status of the preliminary examination?
Okay.
Knowing that right around the corner, we probably have to face another question about the total elimination of the preliminary examination.
Well, I'm aware of what the court's talking about, the criminal procedure rewrite, but that has not passed this session as they anticipated, in part because the state objected. When the proposal does eliminate preliminary hearings, but puts in its place, because the court knows, I mean, the counsel knows there's got to be some independent check on the prosecutor before trial. So there is a motion to dismiss provision in that bill, and the state has objected to that. And because of that, the entire thing has gotten derailed. So it's by no means clear at this point that the preliminary hearing will be completely abolished. As I put in the appendix, in 1982, the Judicial Council did a pretty thorough study of this, and they considered, for all the same reasons we hear now about why the preliminary hearing maybe should be abolished, they decided not to for some very sound reasons, I think. And that I think this court can assume that the legislature is going to change and ultimately abolish it when that hasn't been done yet, and they didn't do it when they changed and created 970.038.
My recollection was, which can be wrong because, you know, this has gone through revision after revision after revision, that there was more discovery allowed to the defendant. So you took away the preliminary, you gave the state something, and you gave the defendant more discovery. But I could be wrong on that. But somehow attempts were made to do a check and balance on this.
There was. And early discovery was one attempt, which some organizations, some victim organizations, are objected to that part of the bill. But the prosecutors want that part of the bill, and defendants want that part of the bill. So there's really, I don't think the court can assume that the parties in the criminal justice system on all sides are going to agree on some proper way to preserve an independent check on the prosecutor without a preliminary hearing.
Now, the amicus brief has a test that's different than yours. Somewhat, it overlaps somewhat, but not entirely. And on page, let's see, I've got it marked on page 7, that although hearsay evidence may be offered in support of probable cause in a criminal complaint and at a prelim as well, and here's the state cannot meet its burden, and I think this is at the preliminary, when it calls a witness to testify at the hearing who, while she has read the criminal complaint, has no personal knowledge about the facts upon which the felony charge is based. That's, as I understand it, that is, and then it repeats it again in the next paragraph, when evidence is introduced at a preliminary exam is based wholly on hearsay, not founded on personal knowledge, and cannot be tested through cross-exam, it's not a good enough standard. So as I read it, that's what the amicus is proposing. And maybe I've misread this brief, but is that your reading of the brief?
I think that's what they're saying, and it is similar to what we've recommended.
Spell it out a little differently. So here's my next question. The complaint is in your appendix, and I checked it out against the record. And as complaints, at least if I'm familiar with, it has 17 counts. And each of the counts is in the statutory language. The above, I'm just going to read one quickly. Above named defendant on or about between, and this is typical in several of these, January 1, 2004 and December 31, 2011. That's a 7 year or so. In the town of blank, 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 as a party to a crime, did engage in abusive, boisterous, indecent, profane, unreasonably loud, contrary to 947.01, 939, blah, blah, class B misdemeanor, and on conviction may be fined not more than $1,000 or imprisoned, etc. That's the standard count in legalese.
Right.
Then there's another provision in the complaint, which is typical. It says probable cause, and then it goes through some of the counts, but not every single one of them, unless my counts and review is wrong, says that who the complainant is and that the complainant reported to, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of the person who signs this, It's Lori something, assigned to be for an assistant DA. And then she reports that she talked to one, as I read it, and I've read it quickly, one of the complaining party who reports about abuse on other children. So will that fit? So does this complaint fit what the standard is in the amicus brief? That's my wind up to a short question.
It might fit on some of the counts. It might fit the amicus.
Not others, is that it?
Not on others, because there was no. She didn't have any independent memory of anything. All she could say is what's in the criminal complaint. So she really wasn't like
some of the counts, but on others she talked to somebody who was the victim.
Yes. Even when she talked to one, SMO.
That's right.
And found out that SMO claimed some of the other children were injured, and when she talked to those, they said no. Or she didn't talk to them when she read their or watched their
videos.
They disagreed or didn't corroborate SMO's version. But more importantly, at the hearing itself, I don't think she would have qualified even under the Michi standard, because she had no independent memory of anything. It wasn't in the criminal complaint. That was it. And
she took the stand.
She testified.
And she didn't have an independent memory.
Correct.
Okay. So she had to refer to this complaint.
That's all she did.
Okay.
So all she did was read the criminal complaint. She was really able to give almost no other information. And so, unlike the standard that the Amici suggests is also one that's used in California, where the investigating officer must be
the one. That's the Peterson case?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
And Whitman. Peterson relies on Whitman. Where the investigating officer has to be have enough information so that the magistrate, if the magistrate wants to, could even question the witness and find out more of the circumstances about the hearsay statement to determine if it's reliable. And here, the witness really couldn't do that. She didn't actually interview any of most of what she did is just sort of passively watch someone else interview. And so in that sense, she was almost doing a double hearsay report, and that she wasn't actually questioning the witnesses. So
is it okay that she signed the complaint? The sole witness at the prelim was the person who signed the complaint, right?
On this complaint, no. Are you talking about for probable cause for a bindover?
At the prelim, the witness was Lori Domino, right?
Right.
And that's the person who is the complaining witness in the complaint.
Right.
Right?
But oftentimes, the person who signs the complaint can just be a liaison officer. In this case, in other words, just because they're the signer of the complaint doesn't make them an officer with personal
knowledge. Just trying to figure out how it translates over. Because, the complaint, there was probable cause in the complaint, right?
Well, arguably, the court actually never ruled on that. But on some of the counts, the ones that we were talking about with Justice Gableman. But the
initial appearance, the probable cause wasn't found?
It wasn't argued at the initial appearance. It was one of these. It was reserved, I believe. And then a motion was actually filed challenging some of these counts that we've talked about. And the court, on the day of the hearing, basically took it under advisement and said, let's go. We got witnesses here. Let's proceed.
Let me just ask you as a practical matter. You don't have an objection to Lori Domino testifying, but you would have had, you would have required that at the prelim, the alleged victims come in, or
if the victim is what I call a transactional witness, almost like the state versus outlaw. If the witness actually personally observed the elements of defense, it could be, for instance, somebody who's a victim of ID theft that really doesn't have anything to add. She, her wallet was stolen, and maybe that's all that took place that makes her a victim. But in cases where the story that the state is offering to establish plausibility that a felony committed, where that's based solely on the victim, then I think the victims either should be, the state should be required because the right to confrontation applies, or the defense should be allowed to call that witness like we tried to do in this case.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Rose.
Good afternoon. I'm Terry Rose. I'm with Rose and Rose Attorneys in Kenosha. I represent Charles Buttes. Mr. Buttes was charged in May of 2012 for conduct which occurred in 2001 and 2004. The preliminary hearing was heard May 3rd of 2012. If we look at the case law prior to Section 970.038 of the Wisconsin statutes, the preliminary hearing is called a critical stage of the criminal justice process. It's just not called a ordinary stage or just another hearing, but a critical stage. A right to a counsel attends at a preliminary hearing. It was always viewed, I believe, as a check on governmental power and authority. The standard or amount of evidence to show probable cause at a preliminary hearing is viewed as more substantial than the probable cause that an officer uses to make an arrest or a district attorney uses to issue a criminal complaint. Why are there so few criminal preliminary hearings, at least in Kenosha, today, if we're talking about a critical stage of the criminal justice process? I think from the defense perspective here, today there really is little point to a preliminary hearing. If it was abolished and this court upheld Section 970.038 of the Wisconsin statutes, I don't think that there would be little difference, very frankly. Typically, someone, an officer or somebody else who may or may not have knowledge of the case, may not have been involved in the case, can be sworn and testify and read the notes, read the reports that may have been drafted by someone else other than the reader. I have been involved in such a preliminary hearing. This particular case, the officer involved had interviewed one of the witnesses, but not the other witness. What kind of cross-examination, I ask you, what kind of cross-examination can there be if one is cross-examining a reader who may not even be involved in the case, and if involved in the case, is merely reading a report what they may not have even been involved with, and maybe another officer's report, another witness's statement? Do I challenge their ability to read? Do I ask them to reread another sentence? I didn't
sir,
quite.
If you focus on plausibility, okay, because we're
all right,
not
well,
proving
let's,
anything, just focusing on plausibility, seems to me the only kind of cross-examination you would be wanting to do is to make whatever statements are coming out of the mouth of the reader or whatever witness is there simply make no sense in regard to the charge that's made, right?
Possibly, but I don't see how a judge or a court commissioner listening to a report being read to that judge or commissioner can decide anything other than it is plausible that probable cause has already been established by the issuance of that criminal complaint. I don't see how the judge at that juncture can say that it's anything other than plausible. You would almost have to say that.
But it's a very light standard. At least I think it's a very light standard.
Well, I agree. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It may be a light standard, but there still has to be some basis to decide plausibility other than the report itself.
But you have two things you have to have be plausible. That a crime was committed, and that the defendant committed the crime. Those are the two things that have to be, quote, plausible. Not proof, just plausible, given what's presented.
Well, there has to be established probable cause to believe that the defendant committed the crime.
Course.
I'm assuming that probable cause means something other than.
But you just have those two. Those are the two facts
true.
You're looking at, right?
And it's true.
Okay, thank you.
I don't see how by merely reading that report, what is defense counsel then do. I would say this. Today, if that is the preliminary hearing that is to be upheld, there's really no need for a preliminary hearing today. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of my time. I can read those reports in my office.
I'll bet you can. my money's on you on that one. I'm going to ask the same question that I asked of the previous attorney. The credibility. If credibility is not an issue at preliminary hearing, and that's black letter, it's been forever.
No dispute.
And outside of, in what has been my experience as both a prosecutor and a trial court judge and here, outside the unusual case where a prosecutor fails to recite or to meet the elements of the offense charge, at least in the recitation, what are you losing? What are you losing that you had before, besides the opportunity, I guess, to converse with whatever witness has been called? Because if you start testing credibility and there's an objection, the judge who follows the law is going to sustain the objection. So what is it that you're losing?
All right. Well, there are cases pre-Section 970.038 where probable cause standard is not met and the court dismisses the case. I agree it's a minority, but I would say that under the current standard, it would be impossible not to find probable cause.
Let's test that, because we're not dealing with credibility. As questions have been said, you're dealing with plausibility. So John Smith comes in, and you can make him whoever he is, and he says, I'm going to read the complaint. And the complaint is signed by someone else. It could be Lori. And the complaint says only that on information and belief, and according to the statute, you can do a complaint on information and belief.
Yes.
And information and belief, the defendant physically abused. You can put it in the right words. Physically abused SMO sometime between December 2004 and December 2011. By hitting him, and then takes all the other 17 or 16, whatever counts, and reads what the affiant said, and the affiant has it all on information and belief. Is that plausible?
Well, under the current statute, I would say it is. It's granted, it's hearsay. How could a judge decide otherwise?
A couple of times hearsay.
Pardon me?
A couple of times hearsay.
Correct. Well, there's no bar against the number of times of hearsay. That is not an argument.
So you think that if it's double and triple that way and you don't have anyone who was an eyewitness or spoke to the eyewitness, that's plausible?
I don't see why a judge couldn't decide it was plausible. There would have to be some other kinds of unusual facts, perhaps stated there, that indicative of this particular case that would cause the judge to say, no, it's not plausible. But just as you describe it, I don't know why that wouldn't be.
But, counsel, couldn't you say the same thing if a witness was called to the stand? And as long as the witness said the words in regard to meeting the elements of the offenses alleged, can't you say the same thing? How could a judge not find it plausible?
Well, first of all, I'll be under oath in the courtroom. Secondly, at least defense counsel has the opportunity to cross-examine, and it may not be as we describe it.
First, yes. I never said it wouldn't be under oath, so I don't know where that came from. And second, I don't understand the second part of your response. There would be what? You would question them, right?
Correct.
And so you agreed with Justice Rogensack's recitation of the judge's a duty at a preliminary hearing to find whether it's plausible that a felony was committed within the jurisdiction and whether it is probable that the one who is charged with it committed the offense. You agreed with those two things.
I do.
So as long as you have a witness who recites the elements, what are you, I still haven't heard you say what you're losing that you had before.
Again, I'm think one, your question almost or statement assumes that the right to cross-examination at a preliminary hearing is not a very important right, whereas I think we are viewing it as an important right to challenge what it is. What those questions would be, I have no idea at this time.
To challenge what?
Well, what there's the statement being made, the accusation being made. If we have no preliminary hearings and a complaint is issued and a warrant or summons are issued and we then go right to the arraignment and then to trial, you have less rights there, don't you, than you have in the grand jury system under the federal system.
Let's say you have the live witness and you get the witness to break down on the stand during your cross-examination and say, you're right, it never happened. Well, you know what? After the witness testified under oath that all the elements did happen, the judge may still lawfully find it plausible that it happened.
This is true. And the judge may also find that it is not plausible because of the details. We're talking in the abstract here. A real live witness making those statements on direct and cross-examination, probable cause might not be found, whereas I think there's no challenge otherwise. If there's no preliminary hearing and no challenge, I say, at least at the grand jury system level, you have the grand jury who is supposed to be checking governmental power. Isn't that what this is really all about?
In a grand jury system, is hearsay admissible?
Yes.
Is there the right to cross-examination?
No, I don't dispute that there is no cross-examination. Defendant is not present. You have no right to counsel, hearsay. But at least in this country, we have always thought that the grand jury, as in England, was a check on governmental authority, that those jurors were there to protect the general public, the accused. We weren't relying on a single judge to make that decision. And that has always been, you know, a high priority under both American and English law.
Counsel, I take it that the law is that, at least the present cases, is that confrontation is at trial.
Correct.
And that the right of confrontation is not, except maybe by statute in other cases, states or case law, is not at a preliminary proceeding or at grand jury. I thought when you started your argument, we did detour you, and you talked about the right to counsel at a critical stage, which this is. That a right to counsel is not a right just to have an attorney sitting there like a potted plant. A right to counsel is a right to effective assistance of counsel, as I understand it. And it seems to me that your argument really is that there is no effective assistance of counsel if you can have a preliminary that has a reader. And because you can't do anything, counsel can't do anything. What can you say? Hey, you didn't read paragraph 3 right. Because if you ask for any information, that person cannot give it to you, right?
That is correct.
And the other part that I thought you were going to make in this argument is that most criminal charges here, if there's a bindover or if there's no preliminary, most of them are plea agreements. So you never get a trial. I mean, you can if you insist on it, but you run the risk of a 17 charges instead of maybe dropping them down to 3.
That is correct.
And run the risk of sometimes overcharging, et cetera. And so in order to avoid that and to get a more favorable a charge and a more favorable, you hope, sentence, there's a plea agreement. So you never do get counsel. And now counsel has to be effective at plea agreements. So we've moved counsel from trial, right, to pretrial in plea agreements. And I thought the argument here might be, okay, I'd like confrontation at preliminaries, but if you don't give me that, recognize that this is a critical stage. Counsel has to be effective, and we don't have very many trials. What percent of trials are there in Kenosha, do you know?
I couldn't tell you exactly, but, I mean, I would agree that if most cases are resolved by plea agreements, guilty pleas, no contest pleas.
Okay. So what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a good argument.
Thank you, counsel.
I couldn't put it any better.
Thank you. Your red light's on. Mr. Castle, Jeffrey Castle, representing the State of Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing today on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. I think before I get into the specific arguments that have been made, I want to look at a few general principles that I think guide the resolution of this case. The first of those principles is one that has already been touched upon. There is no constitutional right to a preliminary hearing. The right is strictly statutory. I've heard defense counsel agree. The legislature is free to abolish the preliminary examination should it choose.
The thing that always disturbs me about that, and we get it in other places too, the federal government can abolish Social Security. But if they've got Social Security and it's a statutory right, it has to be done fairly and equally, and you've got to protect due process. So although you can abolish preliminaries, if you're going to have them, they have to be guided by some basic principles.
I agree. Okay. But I think those limitations, the legislature is free to make whatever changes to the process as long as those changes comport with the Constitution. The only limits on legislative changes to the preliminary examination are those that are required by the Constitution. Because
that's due process.
It could be due process. It could be the right of confrontation. It's been right of – we've had 4 constitutional rights argued in the briefing, confrontation, compulsory process, due process, and effective assistance of counsel. The second point that is kind of the overarching principle is one that also has been discussed here, the very limited purpose of a preliminary hearing. It is a summary proceeding whose purpose is to determine only whether there is a reasonable probability that the defendant committed a felony and that there is a substantial basis for bringing the prosecution. It is a plausibility determination. That is it. The third point I'd like to make is that some hearsay has been admissible at preliminary hearings in Wisconsin for more than 30 years. Since 1980, hearsay has been admissible at prelims to prove ownership of property or lack of consent to entry to or possession or destruction of property. Since 2003, hearsay has been admissible at preliminary examinations to establish any element of identity theft. Crime lab and other laboratory reports are admissible at preliminary or have been before the current statute, were admissible at preliminary examinations without the need to call the preparer of the report. And I think this is perhaps most telling, for the past 20 years, hearsay in cases in which a child has given a recorded audiovisual statement has been admissible at the preliminary hearing. And not only under the statute was the prosecution not required to produce the child and examine the child, the statute expressly prohibits cross-examination of the child. Now, if the defendant's arguments are right, all these statutes are unconstitutional. Yet, to my knowledge, in the 20, 30 years that these statutes have been on the book, they have never been challenged. Preliminary point I want to make is that Wisconsin is far from unique in allowing the use of hearsay as preliminary.
Boy, we dropped that. In any of them, I'd have to go back and look at it, but one of the issues here is reliability. So lab reports are generally not troublesome about reliability. Elements of identity theft, does that raise?
Good. One could argue. It depends on the nature of the case. Since it goes...
Do you have any cases on any of these?
I'm not aware of any cases challenging the constitutionality of any of those provisions. As I said, even though some of them are long-standing, and in my experience, the child-recorded statement is commonly used at preliminary examinations.
Counsel, it seems to me, and I listened to the arguments, the focus for me... Of course, is the constitutional issues, and you're addressing those, and your opposing counsel addressed those. But when it comes to the preliminary hearing with regard to plausibility, and there's been discussion and art back and forth about that, for me, the issue in this case, drilling down, is really on reliability. And why are we here? We're here because there is a change in the statute. And you got to help me because I might be wrong on this. But my understanding is the change in the statute really goes to the issue of not plausibility, but reliability. That is the kind of hearsay that can now be admitted in order to form the basis of a plausibility determination. So I think, for me anyway, that's the essence of it. As I understand it, and I want to tell you what I understand, so correct me if I'm wrong. As I understand it, under the old rule, you could have, of course, hearsay, but subject to the recognized hearsay exceptions. May I add that a recognized exception is, of course, sub 23, which is any other thing that has sufficient indicia of what? Of reliability. That's what this case is about, I think. And perhaps, I don't know, but perhaps lab reports and other things that you mentioned might come under that. So this case for me is about how the landscape has changed, because now you can have any hearsay, regardless if it fit into a hearsay exception. And what's the basis of a hearsay exception? Why do we have hearsay exceptions? Because through the years, we have said hearsay is bad, but aha, this category, and this category, business rules, it has sufficient indicia of reliability. So that's what this case is about, giving the opportunity to challenge reliability, which is at the foundation of plausibility. That's the way I see this case, separate from the constitutional argument. What do you think about that?
I agree with you 100%.
Okay.
Because the statute, while it makes the hearsay admissible, it says the court may base its probable cause finding on, in whole or in part, on that hearsay. So a court is still free, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, to find that the hearsay is not sufficiently enough reliable to establish a plausible account. And we talk about, well, what can a defense counsel do at the hearing? The defense counsel may act as an advocate and argue, you know what, Judge? This hearsay, it's admissible, but it's four steps removed. That's not sufficiently reliable. So I think you're right that reliability is an issue, but I don't think there's any need, when we've heard this parade of horribles in a table of anecdotes. Well, we don't, I would urge the court not to make any decision based on a one or two sentence summary in a table. Any of those defendants was free to challenge Bindover on the ground that there was an insufficient basis for Bindover.
How would you do that in this complaint? And if you had the reader, how would you challenge reliability?
I think
I'm talking about the O'Brien complaint.
Are you talking about the Buttes or the O'Briens?
O'Brien.
Well, I think I don't think it was easy to do. We have a detective who said, "I either was present at the interview or I watched the recordings of the interview." So I think that would be an awfully an uphill struggle. But given the state's relatively low burden, we weren't talking about multiple layers of hearsay. We were talking about a witness who either participated in or watched the statements be made.
Well, what about in Butts?
Well, in Mr. Buttes, I want to point out he is not challenging his Bindover. He is not challenging the sufficiency of the evidence to Bindover. His notice of appeal was from the denial of his motion to find the statute unconstitutional on its face. But that said, had he made the argument, if you look at the transcript of the preliminary hearing, you had the detective reading, it fills six pages of transcript with a witness describing to another detective in some detail what happened, followed at the end by the above statement is true and correct.
You know, counsel, I've been thinking about your response to Justice Bradley's question in regard to, isn't this case about reliability? And if credibility is not an issue at a preliminary hearing, I don't know what the difference is between reliability and credibility. And so the ending of your response came to, well, in any of these cases, the trial court still could have found that it was not plausible. So does it really come down to plausibility, which is already there, which is already the purpose of a preliminary hearing? And as you say, one of the factors could be the further it gets away from a declarant, the less plausible a court could find it. That's what we have trial courts for, is to determine plausibility on relevant factors that they see on a case-by-case basis. So I don't understand your response as to it all comes down to reliability.
Well, I think what I was intending to say was that a judge's determination that the hearsay was so unreliable, and we've had the chief point out that, well, traditionally hearsay depended on admission of hearsay depended on reliability. Now we don't have that as a consideration for admissibility.
Right.
We still have the judge with the, for lack of a better word, discretion to determine whether
what it is.
whether the state has met its burden, and I think in determining plausibility, I guess it's not credibility, but if I think I wouldn't take away from a trial judge the ability to say, you know,
one of the factors I am considering
is that this is fourth level hearsay.
Right. Okay.
That's all I meant to say.
I just.
Sub 5 of 90703 gives the defendant the right, statutory right, to cross-examine witnesses at the prelim and call witnesses on the defendant's own behalf who are then subject to cross-examination. So there's a statutory right to probe, you know, unlike the federal proceeding. It seems to me that if it is merely a reader witness, no personal knowledge, just a reader witness, which is allowable, arguably under the words of the statute as we now have, that renders that statutory right a bit meaningless. Something is not with regard to the constitutional arguments necessarily, but something is very bothersome to me that we have a proceeding that can be a sham. It's bothersome to me because I think it undermines the integrity of the judicial process to have a sham. And it's bothersome to me because we are all too busy to spend our times with shams. So if it's a reader, it's a sham to me. And how do you respond to that? I mean, it just for the integrity of the institution and for the efficiency, it just seems like we shouldn't be putting up with shams.
Well, I think the defense can cross-examination and bring out that the reader has no personal knowledge. In Mr. Butz's case, that's what Mr. Rose did with respect to one of the two complainants.
But that doesn't go to the reliability of what's written on that complaint
and
that
then
he's reading.
The court proceeded to analyze what was in the statement, what other evidence that it had heard, and made a determination. So even though that was, I think, one would describe it as a reader situation, I don't think it was a sham at all. Now, could there be cases in which there's less of an ability to test? Yes, but I don't think the Court of Appeals, I think, said it correctly. This should be something that's decided on a case-by-case basis. I don't think there's a basis for the court to say, we're going to rewrite this statute. And, Mr. Puting has talked about, well, the court can insert some words into the statute. What he's really talking about is inserting four paragraphs into the statute. I don't think, because there in some cases could be you or I might describe as a sham, is not a basis to say, here's a one-size-fits-all rule. We're going to establish these rules. The Court of Appeals was correct, I think, when it says we will trust our circuit judges, to make that determination. And as I said, in any particular case, if a defendant disagrees with the bindover, sufficiency of the evidence for bindover, that defendant has a right to petition for interlocutory review.
I'm inclined to think that all readers' situations are shams. I know you're saying that we shouldn't have a blanket approach to this, and the Court of Appeals was careful not to have a blanket approach to this. But why just not people read it and then have argument? You know, why bother? Statute says the witness has to be sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
You know, well, but he's not saying anything other than reading something he has no personal knowledge about. You can get a fifth grader to come in and do that, right? Right? Does the statute allow a fifth grader to come in and do that?
Assuming the fifth grader has some personal knowledge of the...
give him the complaint. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it'd be a good after-job school for the student.
Not worry about a fifth grader.
For the students here, after-school job. You can come on in and read complaints in court.
But, you know, I think we go back to, even if it's just a reading of the complaint, the purpose is to determine is there probable cause. And, you know, we talked about there are different levels of probable cause at the complaint stage and the preliminary hearing stage. And, frankly, the court has said that many times. If you look at the actual standard, there's scant difference. I think we'd be hard-pressed to identify a case that wouldn't meet them both. I mean, I go back to the TRB case, which is a case in which the court discussed some the differences between the two. And it identified a procedural difference, mm-hmm. that the complaint is a paper review, the preliminary hearing involves a witness. But as to the actual substantive standard, the complaint has to ensure that the document provides a reasonable basis for inferring that a crime had probably been committed and the defendant named in the complaint was probably the culpable party. The state's burden at the preliminary hearing is to show, adduce evidence that establishes to a reasonable probability that a crime has been committed and that the defendant probably committed it.
Yeah, except
there's a difference between that. It's one only lawyers could love.
Well, and no, when you added
absolutely
plausibility
right.
always makes me kind of frown a little bit, because we're asking someone to determine probable cause, which we consider a significant standard. Certainly it's higher than reasonable suspicion. But then you've got plausibility stuck on top of there, which, frankly, to me, it sounds like if it's not incredible testimony, if there's something that's said that either physically couldn't make sense or something that's so significant, I don't know why a statement read by someone who was involved with either hearing it or having reviewed the testimony of the video, I don't know how that wouldn't be plausible. It might not be enough to prove the case at all, but, you know, it's a different standard.
I agree. Now, I think where probable cause, in my experience, and my experience is not at the trial level, it's at the appellate level, but where probable cause is not found, it's because an element has not been
right.
proven. And when Mr. Buting talked about the flashlight example, mm-hmm. and, well, was there an element of intent? The answer, I think, Justice Gable, and you may have suggested it, the answer then is move to dismiss.
Right.
It's not a preliminary hearing issue. In fact, one of the points I was going to make is, at least until today, none of the defendants had argued that the evidence adduced at the preliminary hearing failed to meet the probable cause standard. Now I hear Mr. Buting saying, well, in the flashlight count, because it was just reciting the complaint and the complaint was inadequate, but that's really then a defect in the complaint, if it's a defect.
Well, you know, I don't disagree that you can't tell one probable cause from another, and that you can find a case that would indicate that the probable cause for a, let's see, what's the least one? I'll just take a search warrant. The probable cause for a search warrant looks the same as the probable cause for preliminary, but you've got a lot of cases that say they're not the same. In comparative terms, you've got cases in this jurisdiction that say the degree of probable cause required for a bindover is greater than that required to support a complaint. It's TRB versus State, 109 was second, State v. Knockblock, 44 Wisconsin, State v. Burby, 81 Wisconsin. And I can read you cases that say they're the same. So I don't disagree with you. But that's one of the problems here, that they, the texts of these indicate a difference. I was reading from Jefferson County versus Wrens. I'll tell you what the real problem is. You throw around the words plausibility and credibility, and I defy you to define them.
No, and the courts have...
Can't, and the courts can't, and we know it when we see it, whatever that means.
But I think what it, in the preliminary hearing context, it's pretty clear if...
So if I depend on a UFO, it's not plausible to some judges. Or if I depend on astrology, it's not plausible to some judges, even though I honestly believe what I'm telling you.
Yeah.
And I'm credible.
Now, let me give you an example. This is occurring to me, so this may not work out.
Let's see how it goes. Watch out.
Let's say that at 3:05 this afternoon, there is a bank that's robbed on the west side of Madison. And the suspects, no dispute that's when it occurred, but nobody has identified the witness, the robber. I walk into the police station tomorrow and say, I was there. I can identify the robber. I think if there were an offer of proof made that I can, by a defendant, saying I can put on evidence to prove that Jeff Castle was standing in the Supreme Court at 3:05 on Friday, that might go beyond credibility to plausibility.
Yeah, except you saw on television the tape that was taken at the bank, and you recognized the. So I don't take that.
No, I'm saying I walk in and I said I was there. No, if I said it. The credibility, plausibility is a difficult line, but it's very clear where they, at the meeting place of the two, it can be difficult to distinguish. However, if there's been, say, a charge of battery based on a fight, and, the state puts on a witness, whether it's through hearsay or not, that says, A, threw the punch, and the defense wants to bring in a witness that says, no, A was standing over there, B threw the punch, that's clearly a credibility. That's not a plausibility. So at the edges, it can be hard to distinguish credibility and plausibility.
The Chief Justice touched on something that I wanted to ask, and that is, could you describe what happens when law enforcement secures a search warrant, that process in relation to the preliminary examination under this challenge statute? Can you use hearsay? Can you just read something?
For a search warrant?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have to have firsthand knowledge?
Off the top of my head, I don't think so. I couldn't tell you a case, but...
Well, what's the statute? Do you remember the statute number for search warrants? Although you can have common law search warrants here.
When someone's looking this up, Chief's looking it up, what about revocation hearings or probation or parole? Is hearsay used there?
Sure. Although revocation, that's not a... Criminal proceedings. So I think.
Is it administrative now?
That doesn't.
It can have pretty significant consequences, however.
Yes. Sentencing is a pretty important matter too, but judges can rely on hearsay. Prosecutor can say, by the way, judge, just so you know, the defendant you're about to sentence has been charged in five other cases. So the judge can rely on that. So, I want to get back to this due process notion, because I believe it was the Chief Justice who was talking about the amicus argument. And the argument of the amicus was due process requires a meaningful opportunity to test the evidence that is presented before a neutral magistrate, who then determines whether a plausible account of a criminal offense has been offered. And I heard Mr. Buting say, well, that was close to what he was proposing, not exactly. The problem with that, framing that as a due process argument, is that due process requires that the federal criminal system violates due process. You know, we have grand juries over which there is no judicial supervision. The only lawyer there is the government's lawyer. The Supreme Court said in Costello, back, I believe, in the 1950s, hearsay is admissible. Just last month in the Cayley case, I cited to you in a supplemental authority letter, the Supreme Court said, an indictment fair on its face, returned by a properly constituted grand jury, conclusively determines the existence of probable cause. The grand jury gets to say, without any review, oversight, or second-guessing, whether probable cause exists to think that a person committed the crime. Now, I don't remember whether it was Mr. Rose or Mr. Buting said, well, but we have the citizens who get to decide that, which brings to mind, I think it was Chief Judge Wachler's famous quote from in the 1980s when he said, any prosecutor worth his or her salt can indict a ham sandwich. But in the Wisconsin system, we do have an opportunity for judicial review. It goes beyond what is that in the federal system. And so I think the argument that due process requires an adversarial testing of probable cause is not right.
One of the quotes in the brief was to the Williams case, and I think your opposing counsel even referenced the Williams case with Justice Babbage writing the Williams case. And that reminds me, when you're talking about due process, Justice Babbage used to talk about statutory due process. And I think he even wrote about that, statutory due process. I think he would be looking at sub 5 and says sub 5 of 970.03, which gives the process to the defendant, who, as I referenced earlier, who may cross-examine witnesses and call witnesses to testify. And if there is statutory due process, it seems like there has to be meaningful process. If the statute's given you a right, it has to be a meaningful right.
Well, the right the Court of Appeals has described in the Padilla case is the right to cross-examine the witness who appears. That's the scope of the statute.
I get back to my reader, and I'm kind of hung up on that reader because
I understand.
It seems a bit hollow.
Yeah.
I don't expect you to agree with me. I'm just telling
you.
I want you to disabuse me of that. And
I may not be able to.
You may not.
I appreciate that. I want to get to the other issue that Mr. Buting has relayed, has brought to the court about the inability to the compulsory process, not in the constitutional sense, but the court's denial of or the quashing of the subpoena of the witness. And I think what's important to note there is this court in the Schaefer case not too many years ago set out the standard. And this is a standard under pre-970.038. I don't think it's changed. Although a defendant may subpoena witnesses and evidence for the preliminary examination, His subpoena may be quashed, a witness may not be allowed to testify, or evidence may be excluded if the defendant is unable to show the relevance of the testimony or evidence to rebut the probable cause. Now, at this preliminary hearing, the defense subpoenaed the 17-year-old son. The trial court was practically begging the defense, tell me what you've got to show that is relevant to the plausibility of the account. And I think we all agree that's what is relevant at a probable, at a preliminary hearing. It's evidence that goes to plausibility. What we heard from the defense, well, here's the questions we want to ask. We want to ask, you know, oh, about the flashlight, could it have been an accident? Or the knee and the groin, might it have been an accident? We want the full story. That's not an offer of proof. An offer of proof requires an explanation of what counsel expects the evidence to show, the witness to testify to. Just saying, I want to bring in this witness to get the full story. Well, that's not the purpose of a preliminary examination, to develop the complete story. So the trial court did exactly what a trial court should do. When the state objects to the child victim being called, is to put the defense to its proof, make an offer of proof. And the defense failed to do that. In fact, counsel was candid. She said, I can't say I know what he's going to say. That's not an offer of proof.
I have a question for you. Courts, and this court too, sometimes say, hey, it's not required that A, B, C be done, and we're not going to overturn conviction or whatever we're talking about because A, B, C weren't done here. But it's really good practice if we, prosecutors, defense counsel, whoever, trial courts, do A, B, C. So my question to you is, since I think that at least some people, maybe only defense counsel, think that maybe it's possible to go too far in taking hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay under the rubric that's only plausibility, not credibility. What would a good practice be if you were going to tell trial courts what to do?
I don't think we can say in advance that for any particular case, it's a good practice. Now, there are cases, the O'Brien's brief cited the case, and I'm not recalling the name, in which the court involving hypnotically refreshed testimony. And the court set forth a number of, not standards, but points that a circuit court may consider. But the court, in determining whether to admit hypnotically refreshed testimony, but the court was very careful to say, these are not mandates. These are suggestions. These are good things to consider. We are not requiring the court to do it. Now, this court could come up with a list of recommendations. The court could say, we think in making a plausibility determination, it's appropriate for the court to consider the how many levels of hearsay are involved. But I don't think the court can say, well, one level here says, okay, well, maybe two levels is three, definitely not. Because depending on the case, third level hearsay may be perfectly reliable. So
that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Okay. What else? Any other good practices? Think in terms of plausibility and the levels of hearsay.
No, I mean, I'm not here to suggest that the court add anything to what the legislature didn't put in. I think the legislature, as the Court of Appeals said, left it to the court on a case-by-case basis. I'm not suggesting any of these things. But I am suggesting that if the court were to do something, it would only be kind of a best practices, not a rule.
That's what I'm talking about, best practices.
But I, from my side of the versus, I think the decision is best left to the good sense of the judge.
Another best practice is in considering plausibility. Consider whether a defense has had an opportunity to cross-examine adequately. I mean, I don't know. That just occurred to me as I'm sitting here.
Well, I'm concerned if you do that, because then we run into a situation, well, what about the cases in which the statute specifically says, well, if the state introduces an audiovisual recording of a child 15 or under, as it's permitted to do, and the statute says the child may not be cross-examined, then again, you're going to make a rule of best practice. Consider cross-examination, except in this case where the statute says,
Oh, yeah, but you got special rules for children even at trial, right?
Well, but in terms of confrontation, that's kind of one of the big concerns here. Confrontation, the rule that allows the state to use that audiovisual recording requires, and it protects the confrontation right, the child be made available for cross-examination.
Are you familiar with how extensive preliminary hearings were before the statute was enacted?
What I see is whatever subset of the criminal case law that makes it.
Do you really feel like you're in a position to give the chief best practices on prelims then?
Excuse me?
Do you really feel you're in a position to give
my
colleague best practices on how to do a prelim?
I've never done a prelim.
I just wondered if
well, that
was
undermines your reliability.
It does, absolutely.
I think it's implausible that I'd ask you.
I
trust you, good judgment.
Feel free to disregard anything I have to say about prelims, because I've never done one.
Except for your bottom line, which is to affirm the circuit court.
You've done a lot of appeals.
May I ask,
Justice Prosser,
if there is a preliminary examination and the court does not bind over the defendant, the state has the right to appeal that, doesn't it?
I don't remember whether 97405 gives the state the right to appeal that. Usually what would, I think so, but what's often done is if it's because an element, is the vast majority of times when bind over is denied, it's because the state didn't put in any evidence with regard to an element. And the state is allowed to try again, although it has to say, here's some additional evidence that wasn't considered. It would hardly be worth the appeal if in the typical scenario where the state forgot to put in this was without consent or something like that. If I may follow up,
I may be wrong on the appeal, but I seem to recall some cases in which a decision not to bind over the defendant was appealed and overturned. But now let's say we had a fact situation where the witness was a mere reader, and the circuit court did not bind over the defendant. Could you win that on appeal?
It would be hard. I mean, the review of a bind-over decision is extremely deferential. So I think from the perspective of an appellate lawyer, our advice would very likely be go back and bring another witness. Take the half hour, hour to do that rather than do an appeal. So as a practical matter, I don't think that's how it would proceed. I probably only have a minute or two left. I wanted to make a point about the personal knowledge. In Mr. Buting's reply brief, in the O'Brien's reply brief, they said the state hasn't come to grips with 90602 and tried to square 90602 with hearsay. The reason I didn't address 90602 in my brief is that none of the defendants cited 90602 in their opening brief. But with Mr. Buting having made that point in his reply brief, I'd like to take just a minute to point out that I think the argument about personal knowledge really misunderstands the nature, the relationship between personal knowledge and the hearsay rule. Our Court of Appeals in a case, State versus Peters, 166, the second 168, said lack of personal knowledge is but another way of asserting a hearsay objection. So in many ways, they're two sides of the same coin. And also, look at Judge Weinstein's well-known treatise on the rules of evidence. And in his discussion of Federal Rule 602, on which IR 90602 is based, he has a section, coordination with the hearsay rule. And he writes, Rule 602 is subject to the hearsay rule. A witness may testify as to what he or she, I see my light is on. A witness may testify as to what he or she heard unless what was heard is excluded under the hearsay rules. Well, now we know the hearsay rules don't apply. The witness's testimony may even contain hearsay within hearsay. There is no inconsistency between Rule 602 and the hearsay rules, since the matter the witness is testifying to is what he or she heard rather than the event described by the hearsay declarant. It is the declarant who must have personal knowledge of the underlying event, not the witness. So, I thought I would bring that to the Court's attention in terms of this concern about personal knowledge. And I thank you.
And what's the relation to him on information and belief?
Well, I think that would be I have to say, until I heard you mention it to Mr. Buting, I was unaware that a complaint could be on information and belief.
Sure, and so can a search warrant. That's in the statute on information and belief. Well, then somebody told you, or you saw something from which you've made an inference.
And as I read criminal complaints, the complainant will typically be a detective who says, I've relied on information from Officer X, Y, and Z, who I know to be reliable witnesses, we have existing law on complaints in terms of the use of hearsay in criminal complaints, as long as it's reliable. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Ms. Buting?
We've talked about some of the things that are troubling some of the members of the court, but we haven't talked too much about the constitutional basis that underpins all of this. And I want to touch on that just for a minute, and then I'll see if I can answer the Chief Justice's question about best practices. I want to make it clear that I don't agree that the right to confrontation, the constitutional right to confrontation, does not apply at a preliminary hearing. That is still an open question. I think the United States Supreme Court is moving in that direction. They recognize that this is a system of pleas, not trials. 94% of cases in the state courts end up in pleas, not trials. So to rely solely on an eventuality that only happens in 6% of the time to protect an individual's rights, the Supreme Court, I think, is recognizing that that's it's time to move back to the roots of what the right to confrontation means. The Sixth Amendment says that it applies in all criminal prosecutions. If you look at the Sixth Amendment, other rights, the right to counsel applies before trial. The right to a public trial applies before trial. You can't have a closed preliminary hearing in most cases. So the day is coming when I think the Supreme Court is going to rule that there is a right to confrontation, a constitutional right to confrontation at an adversarial preliminary hearing. And that's one of the important things that distinguishes this from a grand jury. It is an adversary hearing. It's set up that way. And because of that, and because it's an adversary hearing and it can affect one's trial rights down the road, the court has ruled that it's a critical stage. And if it's a critical stage, enough that you have to have an attorney, then the attorney has to be more than just a potted plant who sits there and can't do anything, then argue, as counsel suggested, well, you could argue that there wasn't enough elements just on the criminal complaint. But that ignores the rest of the statute that says you have a right to cross-examine and present evidence. So when the legislature creates a system that involves all of those rights, you can't just arbitrarily take it away and say, because they've changed only one little bit of it and allow hearsay, you no longer can cross-examine and you no longer can call witnesses.
Do you think it can effectively cross-examine without having discovery?
Well, we argued in Schaefer, actually.
Right, that's what I was thinking about, actually.
Yes, well, the court didn't want to go that far, and I understand that. The court ruled ultimately that counsel was not handcuffed, I think was the phrase, by not having the reports ahead of the trial. But clearly counsel is handcuffed now. If you are at a preliminary hearing and don't have not only the police reports, but you can't even question the witness who hasn't any personal knowledge, you are handcuffed. How are you supposed to determine or show the court that there's a lack of plausibility in the state's allegations? And certainly if this statute is constitutional, then the court has to instruct the lower courts to be more liberal in the other statutory rights, the right to call a witness. I totally disagree with counsel that an offer of proof at a preliminary hearing would require defense counsel to say exactly what a witness would say. There's no case law that says that. It's contrary to Wilson and other cases that have talked about what you can do in calling a witness and when you can call a witness. You just can't challenge their credibility or their trustworthiness. But you should be able to call a witness if the subject matter is limited to the allegations of the incident itself. Some of the cases, Evanow and Cece, talk about the 5 W's or 6 W's that's required in a complaint. If the state wanted to call SMO, the state would have been relevant. All the questions that we wanted to ask would have been relevant for the state to ask. So why are they somehow not relevant if the defendant chooses to call the witness? It's a complete double standard. And the answer is because it's not required that you do that kind of offer of proof. Maybe at a trial, it's different. In the middle of a trial, you should know what a witness is going to say, but not this early in the proceedings. So we've talked about plausibility and reliability and all of these things that are very difficult. But when it comes to best practices, certainly if the defense counsel wishes to call a witness that would present testimony, may I finish?
Yes, you may finish. Please.
That wishes to present a witness that will whose testimony will relate to those 5 W's: the when, how, what, who says so, and only those, and will not delve into credibility at all. Then that should be permitted, and it should be clear that kind of offer of proof is all that's needed, not what counsel suggested.
Well, can we hold for you without overruling either Mitchell or Padilla?
I'm sorry?
Can we hold for the defendants without overruling Mitchell or Padilla?
You can hold without overruling Mitchell, and with Padilla, you can also limit it because it was as the court talked about earlier, one of those hearsay exceptions that was deemed reliable. It was different when Padilla had the mother of the child, and Padilla said you could cross-examine that witness about the circumstances of the utterance. Was it really an excited utterance exception? Did it fit those indicia of reliability? Oliver was another case just like it, and where a child wasn't allowed to testify, wasn't competent, and the father talked about it. But the father was able to be cross-examined about what he observed. Did you see injuries on the child? Did you see this, that, and the other thing? So those cases, if the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation doesn't make you overrule those cases, they can still be limited to circumstances where there's indicia of reliability, not like the kind of hearsay we had in the O'Brien's case.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. And thank you to all three counsel, Mr. Rose, Mr. Feeding, and Mr. Castle, for a different approach and fact situation for the Crawford case, as well as a review of the preliminary examination. Thank you for your briefs. Thank you for your oral argument. And that ends our hearing in Wisconsin State versus the two O'Briens in Mr. Buttes. The court will have a recess until 4 o'clock, at which time we'll meet in closed conference. The court will meet again for oral argument next week. We are in recess.